suitable to the residents of a civilized people. By opening this intercourse between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and forming regular establishments through the interior and at both extremes, as well as along the coasts and islands, the entire command of the fur trade of North America might be obtained from latitude 48. North to the pole, except that portion of it which the Russians have in the Pacific, in Alaska. To this may be added the fishing in both seas and the markets of the four quarters of the globe. No wonder the Northwest Company liked Mackenzie. He thought big, and he thought like a businessman. The fire he lit, however, was not under the company or the British government, but under Jefferson. The news that the British were threatening to set up shop in the Northwest galvanized Jefferson into manic activity and changed Meriwether Lewis's life overnight. Sometime late that summer, or in the fall of 1802, it is impossible to tell even what week, much less the moment, President Jefferson informed Captain Lewis that he would command an expedition to the Pacific. Or Captain Lewis talked President Jefferson into giving him the command. We don't know when or how Jefferson made his decision that there would be an American answer to Mackenzie and that Lewis would lead it. Evidently, he consulted no one, asked no one for advice, entertained no nominees or volunteers other than Lewis. This was the most important and the most coveted command in the history of exploration of North America. Jefferson was confident that he had the right man under his roof. Later, Jefferson explained why he chose Lewis rather than a qualified scientist. It was impossible to find a character who, to a complete science in botany, natural history, mineralogy, and astronomy, joined the firmness of constitution and character, prudence, habits adapted to the woods, and a familiarity with the Indian manners and character requisite for this undertaking. All the latter qualities Captain Lewis has. That was not to say Lewis was ignorant of science. Further, Lewis had demonstrated a remarkable ability to learn, especially with Jefferson as his teacher. Jefferson's library at Monticello was the most extensive in the world on the subject of the geography of the North American continent. Lewis had the run of the library. He consulted maps and conferred with Jefferson over them. In Professor Allen's words, "It must be assumed that he and the president talked at great length about the nature of the country west of the Mississippi and the possible character of the speculative passage to Pacific waters." From his later journals, we know that Lewis read Captain James Cook's A Voyage to the Pacific Ocean, London, 1784, the account of Cook's third voyage to the Pacific Northwest. It almost certainly was at this time that he read it. He also read Antoine Seymour Lepage Duprat's The History of Louisiana or of the Western Parts of Virginia and Carolina, London, 1763, and took it with him on his expedition. He read other books and consulted more maps. He took botany lessons from Jefferson, who taught as they walked through the gardens at Monticello or later in the season along the banks of the Potomac. Jefferson once said no country gentleman should be without what amuses every step he takes into his fields, and he ranked botany with the most valuable of sciences. Whether we consider its subjects as furnishing the principal subsistence of life to man and beast, delicious varieties for our tables, the adornments of our flower borders, or medicaments for our bodies. Jefferson introduced Lewis to the Linnaean system of affixing binomial Latin names and taught him enough to use the system in the field. He taught Lewis how to use a sextant and tried to teach him the use of the equatorial theodolite. Lewis rightly believed that he had Jefferson's complete confidence. They had a cipher so that they could communicate secretly, which might be necessary, since Jefferson had told Lewis privately that he would be sending the expedition into foreign territory. The Spanish might protest. They talked about the Indians along the Missouri, of their attachment to the British trading posts north of the Missouri, and of the possibility of bringing the tribes into the American orbit. They talked of finding the Welsh Indians on the Missouri. They talked flora and fauna, mountains and rivers. They talked about the size of the party, whether too many would alarm the Indians to the point of active war, whether too few would invite an Indian attack to seize the rifles and supplies. They agreed on the basic need to bring back accurate records, descriptions, and maps. In short, between the time Mackenzie's book arrived at Monticello and December 1802, Jefferson gave Lewis a college undergraduate's introduction to the liberal arts, North American geography, botany, mineralogy, astronomy, and ethnology. In the fall of 1802, back in the president's house, Jefferson and Lewis continued their preparations for the expedition. While Lewis drew up an estimate of expenses to present to Congress as part of a request for an appropriation, Jefferson began to widen the circle of those who knew about the proposal. The first outsider brought into the plan was Carlos Martinez de Irujo, the Spanish minister to the United States. Martinez was married to the daughter of Governor Thomas McKean of Pennsylvania and was on friendly terms with Jefferson. In fact, had found a cook for the president. On December 2nd, Martinez reported to the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Madrid that Jefferson had asked him, in a frank and confident tone, if our court would take it badly that the Congress decree the formation of a group of travelers who would form a small caravan and go and explore the course of the Missouri River with no other view than the advancement of the geography. Jefferson, Martinez reported, had explained that, as a strict constructionist of the Constitution, he could not ask Congress for an appropriation for a mere literary expenditure, so he intended to lie to Congress and pass the expedition off as one designed to promote commerce, which was a power given Congress by the Constitution. At this point, Jefferson was into a third or fourth degree of indirection. Martinez cut him off. I replied to him that making use of the same frankness with which he honored me, I would take the liberty of telling him that an expedition of this nature could not fail to give umbrage to our government. Jefferson could not see why. The only subject would be to fill in the map, which would benefit everyone. Martinez did not believe him, any more than Jefferson had believed the British in 1783 about the purposes of their proposed exploration, or Louis XVI about the purposes of the La Perouse expedition of 1785. Martinez told his government, "The president has been all his life a man of letters, very speculative and a lover of glory, and it would be possible he might attempt to perpetuate the fame of his administration by discovering the way by which the Americans may someday extend their population and their influence up to the coast of the South Sea, Pacific Ocean." Martinez knew his man. Undeterred by Martinez's negative reaction and his refusal to give Captain Lewis a passport, Jefferson plunged ahead. In the late winter of 1802-3, he got a passport for Lewis from the British minister and another from the French. Simultaneously, he moved forward with the Monroe Project to purchase New Orleans from Napoleon. Lewis, meanwhile, completed his estimate. He based it on the cost for a party of one officer and 10 to 12 soldiers, surely reflecting a decision he and Jefferson had made together about the ideal size, and kept it as low as possible to avoid congressional criticism. With $696 for Indian presence as the largest expenditure, and other large sums for provisions, mathematical instruments, arms, medicines, and a boat, it came to $2,500 on the nose. Jefferson put a request for that amount into his first draft of his annual message to Congress in December 1802. When Treasury Secretary Gallatin saw the draft, he suggested that the request be confined to a separate, later, confidential message, as it contemplates an expedition out of our own territory. Jefferson agreed and sent up a special, secret message to Congress on January 18, 1803. Even then, he buried the request in a discourse on the Indian problem, couching it in terms of commerce. "The River Missouri and the Indians inhabiting it," he said, "are not as well known as is rendered desirable by their connection with the Mississippi and consequently with us. It is, however, understood that the country on that river is inhabited by numerous tribes who furnish great supplies of furs and pelty to the trade of another nation carried on in a high latitude through an infinite number of portages and lakes shut up by ice through a long season. The Missouri, traversing an area with a moderate climate, might offer a better source of transportation, possibly with a single portage from the Western Ocean." Those congressmen who were listening hard got the clear message. We can steal the fur trade from the British. It would not cost much. One officer and a dozen soldiers, who would have to be paid regardless, could explore the whole line, even to the Western Ocean. They could talk with the Indians, persuade them to accept American traders, agree on the sites for trading posts. They could do all of this in 2 summers and for a pittance. Jefferson concluded, "The interests of commerce place the principal object within the constitutional powers and care of Congress, and that it should incidentally advance the geographical knowledge of our own continent cannot but be an additional gratification." He then asked for an appropriation of $2,500 for the purpose of extending the external commerce of the U.S. There was some muttering from the Federalists, who always resented and resisted spending money on the West, but they were too badly outnumbered to be effective. Congress approved the whole package. The $2,500 went down easy compared with Jefferson's request the previous week, which had been for an open-ended, up to $9,375,000, appropriation for the purchase of New Orleans. The Federalists had protested over the amount of money and because some of the high Federalists were clamoring for war against France. But the Republicans held firm, and the Congress made the appropriation. The President selected Monroe to go to Paris to join Livingston in the negotiations. If Jefferson saw the link between the January 12th and the January 18th appropriation bills, he never mentioned it to anyone, except perhaps Lewis. As soon as the appropriation for Western exploration passed, as Jefferson recalled it, Captain Lewis immediately renewed his solicitations to have the direction of the party. Perhaps command really was still an open question. More likely, Jefferson was pretending that until Congress had authorized the expedition, he had made no choice of a leader. Whatever his reason for the remark, Jefferson never hesitated to confirm Lewis's appointment. Jefferson, by this time, had spent 2 full years with Lewis on a daily basis and had taught Lewis on an intense schedule for about 4 months. He later wrote that, by the beginning of 1803, "I had now had opportunities of knowing him intimately." Jefferson gave his reasons for picking Lewis to Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia. "Captain Lewis is brave, prudent, habituated to the woods, and familiar with Indian manners and character. He is not regularly educated, but he possesses a great mass of accurate observation on all the subjects of nature which present themselves here, and will therefore readily select those only in his new route which shall be new. He has qualified himself for those observations of longitude and latitude necessary to fix the points of the line he will go over." Lewis still had much to learn. To that end, Jefferson had plans for him to do graduate work in Philadelphia with America's leading scientists. That Lewis would benefit, Jefferson had no doubt. That Lewis could simultaneously plan the expedition and begin putting it together, Jefferson had no doubts. Some of his advisors did. They considered Lewis not well educated and perhaps too strong-headed and too much of a risk-taker. But Jefferson was sure he had the right man. Chapter 7. Preparing for the Expedition. January to June 1803. A week after Congress appropriated the funds for the expedition, Jefferson began writing his scientific friends. The message was the same in each case. "The expedition has been authorized, but is still confidential. I have chosen Captain Lewis to lead it. Lewis needs advice and instruction." The letters made it clear that Jefferson intended the recipients to provide advice and instruction without cost to the government. Lewis's schooling began during the period from New Year's Day to the Ides of March. Lewis was still living in the President's house, conferring with Jefferson as often and for as long as Jefferson's schedule would allow. Beyond the conferences and the practical lessons in the use of the sextant and other measuring instruments, which took place on the lawn, Lewis studied maps in Jefferson's collection. He also conferred with Albert Gallatin, a serious map collector. Gallatin had a special map made up for Lewis showing North America from the Pacific coast to the Mississippi, with details on what was known of the Missouri River up to the Mandan villages in the Great Bend of the river, today's Bismarck, North Dakota, and a few wild guesses as to what the Rockies might look like and the course of the Columbia. There were but 3 certain points on the map: the latitude and longitude of the mouth of the Columbia, of St. Louis, and of the Mandan villages, thanks to British fur traders. By the time he finished studying with Jefferson and Gallatin, Lewis knew all that there was to know about the Missouri and what lay to the west of it. The problem was that west of the Mandans, nearly to the coast, was terra incognita, and the best scientists in the world could not begin to fill in that map until someone had walked across the land, taking measurements, providing descriptions of the flora, fauna, rivers, mountains, and people, not failing to note the commercial and agricultural possibilities. To make that journey required a frontiersman's expert knowledge combined with an understanding of technology and what it could do to make the passage easier and more fruitful. That was the positive side of Jefferson's choice of Lewis, who was, in fact, the perfect choice. Indeed, Lewis's career might almost have been dedicated to preparing him for this adventure. He knew the old Northwest about as well as any man in the country. He knew lonely forest trails through Indian country. He knew hunting and fishing and canoes. He knew how to keep records, had adequate mathematical skills, and for 2 years had been privy to Mr. Jefferson's hopes and dreams, his curiosity and knowledge. Jefferson told Patterson that Lewis had the required frontier skills, to which he joins a great stock of accurate observation on the subjects of the three kingdoms. He has been for some time qualifying himself for taking observations of longitude and latitude to fix the geographical points of the line he will pass over. But he needed help, and it was Patterson's and the other scientists in Philadelphia's privilege and, not stated but clearly implied, duty to supply that help. Of course, they were all delighted to do so anyway. It was a favorite saying of one of President Jefferson's 20th century successors, Dwight Eisenhower, that in war, before the battle is joined, plans are everything, but once the shooting begins, plans are worthless. The same aphorism can be said about exploration. In battle, what cannot be predicted is the enemy's reaction. In exploration, what cannot be predicted is what is around the next bend in the river or on the other side of the hill. The planning process, therefore, is as much guesswork as it is intelligent forecasting of the physical needs of the expedition. It tends to be frustrating because the planner carries with him a nagging sense that he is making some simple mistakes that could be easily corrected in the planning stage, but may cause a dead loss when the mistake is discovered midway through the voyage. For this expedition, planning was going on at two levels. The president was working on the first draft of his instructions to Lewis. It was becoming a long, complex document, for Jefferson was making a list of the things he wanted to know about the West. Since there was so much he wanted to know, far more than a single expedition could answer, he had to make choices. There was no mention of looking for gold or silver in the draft Jefferson was circulating, for example, whereas soil conditions and climate were included. Trade possibilities were prominent. Taken altogether, the instructions represented a culmination and a triumph of the American Enlightenment. The expedition authorized by the popularly elected Congress would combine scientific, commercial, and agricultural concerns with geographical discovery and nation-building. All the pillars of Enlightenment thought, summed up with the phrase "useful knowledge," were gathering in the instructions. While Jefferson worked on the instructions, Lewis had his own planning to do. Jefferson would set the objectives, but it was Captain Lewis who would get the expedition there and back. The responsibility was his for deciding the size of the expedition, how it would proceed up the Missouri River, what it would need to cross the Rocky Mountains and descend the Columbia to the Pacific Ocean and return. The team would have to do this as a self-contained unit. Once the expedition left St. Louis, Lewis would be stuck with the decisions he had made during the planning process. How many men? With what skills? How big a boat? What design? What type of rifle? How much powder and lead? How many cooking pots? What tools? How much dry or salted rations could be carried? What medicines in what quantity? What scientific instruments? What books? How many fishing hooks? How much salt, tobacco, whiskey? Lewis and Jefferson talked into the late evening about such questions. Jefferson thought it would be a good idea to carry some cast-iron corn mills to give the Indians as presents. Lewis agreed. They discussed the trade beads that were the currency of the western Indian tribes and agreed that plenty would be needed. they made up lists of other items. Together, they concocted the idea of a collapsible iron frame boat, one that could be carried past the falls of the Missouri, wherever that might be, and put together at the far end with animal skins to cover it, so that the expedition would be back in business on the water. They talked about timing. Now that the appropriation was in hand, both men wanted to get started as soon as possible. With the coming of spring and the drying of the roads, Lewis wanted to be ready to go. He told Jefferson he hoped to be across the Appalachians by early summer. He intended to go to the post at Southwest Post, near present Kingston in eastern Tennessee, and there enlist his core group of soldier explorers from the garrison. He planned to march them overland to Nashville, where he would pick up a previously ordered keelboat to float down the Cumberland River to its junction with the Ohio, not far above the Ohio's junction with the Mississippi. He planned to be in St. Louis by August 1st and thought he might be able to proceed a good bit of the way up the Missouri before being forced into winter camp. In 1804, he expected to cross the mountains, reach the Pacific, make the return journey, and report back before winter set in. Lewis and Jefferson talked through January and February and on into March, trying to imagine what the trip was going to be like so that they could be certain of what would be needed. But that was only the half of it. The other half involved preparing Lewis for the scientific observations he would be responsible for making. That meant study. Hard, intensive study in a variety of disciplines under a severe time pressure. On the Ides of March, Lewis left Washington for Harper's Ferry, site of the U.S.